Welcome. You are listening to Our Burning Questions, a professional learning podcast where we love to talk about teaching multilingual learners. I'm your host, Colette Ferron Goodwin, and I'm a resource specialist on the EML team with the Mid-State Regional Bilingual Education Resource Network at OCM BOCES in Syracuse, New York. Thanks for joining us. Welcome to another episode of Our Burning Questions. Our Burning Questions for today are, how can we support emergent multilingual learners in early childhood and their families? And how can increasing teacher capacity through communities of practice impact serving ELLs? And here to respond to these questions is my very special guest, Dr. DJ Kaiser. Welcome, Dr. Kaiser.
Hello, thank you. Thank you so much for asking me.
Yeah, it's great to have you. So, Dr. Kaiser, could you just tell us a little bit about yourself, what your special areas of interest are, and what drew you to working with ELLs?
Sure. So, I'm a professor and director of Teaching English to Speakers of Other Languages, TESOL. We've got a Master of Arts in TESOL program at Webster University. So, we're based in St. Louis, Missouri. We've got a program in St. Louis, a grant project that I've been working on. We're in our sixth year for that, and we'll be talking a lot about that today. We've got an online program and a large program in Uzbekistan, and also a cohort of students in Athens, Greece. Wow. So I've been at Webster now. This is my 12th year. And then I would say I've been in the field of English language teaching, started about 25 years ago.
Wow. Yes. And just looking at your website, all of the amazing work that you have done already, I'm very excited to talk about it and share it with our listeners as well. So you've obviously done a lot of work with emergent multilingual learners in early childhood. And as a matter of fact, you have agreed to be one of our keynote speakers for our symposium, their 2023 symposium. So we're really excited to have you for that. So what challenges do families of emergent multilingual learners in early childhood face?
Well, good question. So I guess I'll kind of frame the kind of the direction that I'm coming from. So I'm working with a team here at Webster University. We have a national professional development grant from the U.S. Department of Education. It's a five-year grant. We're now in our sixth, a no-cost extension year. So we've been working with more than 120 K-12 teachers. The most of them are content teachers who are seeking their Missouri ELL certification. Okay. And as part of our project, in addition to the courses they take that are needed for Missouri ELL certification, we've developed a series of Saturday seminars around a framework that we call the Teacher-Student Success Network. And so this Teacher-Student Success Network, it focuses on seven different actors. So I guess the way that we approach this was a little bit different, where for the project, rather than looking up what does the research say to be able to answer questions, we came up with a framework working with two community partners in the area. And so the actors that we focus on are the teacher, the student, the parent, the school, the family unit, the community, and the world. And then we have a total of eight seminars. And so those are seven actors. So our eighth seminar is the teacher changed. And so the purpose of this approach with the TSSN is we have developed activities where we get together K through 12 teachers. And we put them into groups to work with mentor teachers, so experienced ELL teachers in school districts. This is all in the St. Louis area. And we give them activities to do where they start exploring different ideas that are based on one of the different actors. And with this, they start generating their own knowledge and their own plans to meet the needs of ELLs, emergent multilinguals, their families, the community. And so that's been our approach. That's sort of that background.
Yeah. So why is it important to focus on emergent multilingual children at this early stage in their lives? What's important about that?
Oh, so there, I think when I was getting into the field of TESOL, there was a lot more focus on adult learners. And there was sort of a sense that, younger learners, they'll just pick up the language. And we don't believe that now. We believe in the importance of working with learners at all different levels and being inclusive of early childhood, of early learners, and recognizing the important role that families play in learning language. And that is learning your home language, that's learning the language of instruction, that's learning the languages that are surrounding you, so that students and families are benefiting from being able to participate in their classroom, in their school community, in their greater community to express themselves. So I think when we take that approach of, it's not just a matter of what's the language that's going to be needed once they start to get tested, because we all know that there's that accountability aspect.
Yes.
We need to make sure that everyone in the family is able to express themselves and make connections and feel like they're part of that community, because that's when all these other pieces, at least I believe, are really going to come together and help our young learners, their older siblings, their younger siblings, other members of their family all succeed.
And I'm seeing a common thread here, and it seems to be very asset-based.
Oh, yes.
And I think, you know, I'm asking questions about challenges and misconceptions, and you really are focusing more on the assets. And I think that's an important message to send, because that's what you're capitalizing on. That's what we mean to do when we work with English language learners and their families, right? We capitalize on their assets.
Absolutely. So when we look at a funds of knowledge approach of what are the great resources that learners bring to the classroom. So I was just reviewing a lesson plan from a teacher who was introducing a work where the story includes Spanish speakers, and there's some words in Spanish that are part of the story. Mm-hmm. And the teacher wrote into the lesson plan, leaning on the Spanish speaking students to pronounce these words
Love
for
it.
Other students in the class and to define those words. Mm-hmm. And so when we take that approach of recognizing that we live in a multilingual world, we don't live in a world where English is the only language that's spoken around us. It's not the only language that we're going to be exposed to. And as we get more streaming services now, mm-hmm. I think we're finding more and more adults are finding themselves exposed to more languages, more cultures. I know that I've been watching more shows that are subtitled into English in languages that I don't know. When I watch something in Spanish, I don't need to watch the subtitles as much.
Right.
And so I think there is more of this curiosity and desire for all of us to learn more about the world, other languages. And when we learn just some of these different words, ways to say hello, how do you say this in your language, or how is this done in your culture or in your family, it really does broaden our horizon.
Yes, absolutely. And we, you know, we both share the love of linguistics, because I also have a concentration in English, in linguistics as well.
Yay!
So yay for linguistics. And so I think of language when I listen, when I hear other languages, I think of listening to a beautiful song.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's like I tune my ears to just to listen, even though maybe I don't understand what they're saying. I listen, and I just listen to the sounds and how they form them. And so it's, I have that appreciation for languages, like somebody might have an appreciation for a symphony, per se.
Yes. No.
So speaking of languages, I wanted to talk about your work with the Reggio Emilia approach, because there's a mention of the 100 languages. And I think it's so empowering. And I did a little bit of research on this because I was not familiar with it. And okay. the poem that was written that yes. was to go along with this, that was translated. And wow, it really changed my perspective on viewing early learning. Could you talk a little bit about the work that you've done with that so far?
Sure. So first of all, I do need to make clear that I am by no means an expert on Reggio Emilia. Okay. So that there are other people we would definitely want to go to who are experts on that. But I had a great opportunity. I think this was in 2019 to go with a group of educators to Reggio Emilia, Italy. And it's a community that's very much community focused, really focused on family involvement in young learners. So I had the opportunity to visit infant care centers, early childhood centers, preschools that are committed to this Reggio Emilia approach, where they talk about the 100 languages of children. So the idea is that there's not one language. So here we're looking at Italy, where you may look at that Italian is the language of instruction that will be expected as they go through. But in Reggio Emilia, they look at all these different languages of children. So dance would be one of these languages, sculpture, painting, explorations of light. And it was just so fascinating for me to be able to go into, first of all, to hear from different experts talk about the Reggio Emilia approach. For me, it was very much a learning experience of focusing more attention on the needs of early learners. I started out very much in the adult education world and then started working more with K-12 teachers. And then this project allowed me to focus more on early childhood. And so I've got a chapter that'll be coming out where in that chapter, I'm looking at the concept of translation, that through this approach, what I found was there were multiple modes of translation. And if we open up our minds to what is language and what is communication, because the traditional sense is that language is something that we speak or it's something that we write down. And as we look at the Reggio Emilia approach with the 100 languages of children, it really opens and broadens that to something that's much more multimodal. And this is supported by more and more research, even as we look at K-12 and adult education for language learning, is that language learning is not just the spoken and the written language. Just an example, I'm working on a textbook that will be coming out hopefully in a year or two, and it's on pronunciation and it's for teaching adults. But one of the things that I work with a lot is the use of gestures. And there's research that shows that the use of gestures actually helps and facilitates with the different stresses that we need to use in the English language. And people will see the gestures and it actually makes our stresses louder. So this is at the adult level. With early childhood, we're looking at learners who they really can express themselves in so many different ways. Mm. And going back to that asset-based approach.
Yeah.
So when we have young learners, emergent multilinguals who are put into a school where there's often this expectation that they have the same level of English as other students, other peers, then that's when we end up with this deficit of approach of where they may be behind. But when we take this multimodal approach and we see all the different resources that they have of their home languages and all the different ways that they can communicate and express themselves, it makes everything so much more magical. And I just loved seeing in Reggio Emilia the role that educators played in, they called it documentazione, so documentation. So essentially what they're doing is they are exploring how their learners are experiencing the world, participating in the world, expressing themselves through different modalities, and then they're translating it. So they're facilitating this translation into Italian, and also through photographs, so that there can be posters that are hung throughout the school. They'll do different public displays. They'll have actually curated museum exhibits where you'll get to see, here's a project where children are working with, so they call them atelieristas. So the atelier working with sculptors and learning how to sculpt. So you look at the process. So take photographs of this process, and then you are explaining this process, talking about this process, documenting it, labeling it, and putting it on display for parents to see, for family members to see, members of the community to see. And it was just so great to see so many of these exhibits in schools and in public spaces. It was a very, I wonder what our world would be like if we approach more instruction like that.
Yeah. And thinking about how our education system is here in the United States, it really opens your eyes to that. And I also noticed when I was reviewing your credentials, you have a degree in drama also.
I do.
So, and when you mentioned gestures, I thought, wow, okay, that's, I see where that.
Yes. Yes. It's, I think that's another thing when we look at teachers also. So I do teacher training, teacher preparation, and I get a lot of people who come from different fields where they'll come into my office, we'll be talking on the phone or on Zoom, and they seem to almost have this deficit approach to themselves of, well, I'm not from this field. Well, I don't know this. And we start to look at, what do you have? What do you have that is going to make you a strong and unique instructor? And when we start with that, we start to see that a lot of teachers are bringing so many great things. And what I learned from drama, so when I was younger, I loved being on stage. It taught me to use my voice. It taught me to articulate, to enunciate. If I'm in a large room and the microphone goes off, I can find a way to make sure that people in the back of the room can still understand me. These are really important techniques in the classroom.
Sure.
Being more animated, like you're on stage, and using gestures, using facial expressions. These are things that will help learners understand you better. And I know there are a lot of theater-based techniques. I've used some of them. I probably don't use as many theater-based techniques as other people do. With a similar background. But yeah, drama will always be a major love of mine.
Yeah, it's interesting how you see education and educating teachers and students through that lens as well. I think it's great. And you said, like you said, everybody has their own unique abilities and, you know, assets, and teachers are unique just like their students are.
Yes, I mean, I find I'm always learning from my students and I'm always learning from other teachers. So when I do that with observing classes, so I have the opportunity to observe teachers in the classroom. That's always one of my favorite things to do. And I never walk in with a preconceived list of these are the things that I'm looking for. My approach is very much, and I will tell people, I'm going to walk in with a blank piece of paper. And I will put down what time it is, and then I just start to write down what I see, and I identify, so what are the great strengths that I'm seeing in your classroom, And then I'll look at what I'll talk about. I like to call them missed opportunities. So here was an opportunity. And that way it's a missed opportunity rather than this is something that you failed to do. It's just there was an opportunity to do this.
Right.
And so it's always in this positive sense. And I think taking that approach throughout education is what are we observing? And I think that's one of the things I liked about this Reggio Emilia approach is just how much observation was part of it.
Right.
And a lot of the learning was guided through observing learners to see what their process was.
I think it's amazing though that you're in higher education, but yet you're still connected to the classroom. I think that it's so important, and it's great that you have the opportunity to be connected that way, especially when you're training teachers, right? Because you've got that knowledge and experience, and sometimes teachers go through preparation programs that there are things that they never learn until they get out into the field. So I think it's wonderful that you're able to stay connected in that way.
Well, for me, I find it's extremely important to do that. As I mentioned, my background is with adult education. And now that I find myself working with a lot of K through 12 teachers, it's a different type of classroom. It's a different type of learner. So I have to spend time in the classrooms, really seeing how people interact. I remember there was a school that brought me in to do some professional development for their teachers. And I said, so in order to do this, I want to take time and I want to get to know what your teachers are, the context that your teachers are working in.
Right.
So I took 3 different days. And so they had 2 EL teachers for the school. This was an elementary school. And I said, so one day I want to follow one of your EL teachers from when she starts to when she goes home. And then the next day I want to follow the other from when she starts to when she goes home. And then I want you to choose one English learner. And I'm going to follow that English learner from when he arrives at school to when he leaves. And they said, well, he comes in early this day for additional tutoring. I said, then I will come in early and I'll arrive at the same time because I want to see what a whole day is like from that student perspective. And it really helped me understand things so differently. It's changed a lot of how I approach and think about working with teachers and helping them.
And the shadowing piece, that's it's interesting that you are shadowing teachers, because usually when we think about shadowing, especially with English language learners, it's the students that we shadow, not the teachers.
Right. I think it is important to see what it is like to be a teacher of English learners in schools today, because sometimes when we go in and we see one class, it may be a little more of an idealized version.
Right.
But getting an opportunity to see that this teacher doesn't have a dedicated classroom. And so this teacher is working with students in a corner of the library. This teacher is working with students sitting around a desk in the hallway. And so these are things that I have seen. I get to see when teachers are pushing into a class, when they're pulling students out, when they're pulling students out, and then how many students are coming from different sections. So then we could start to have different conversations about what are some of those decisions, why those decisions are being made, and start to have conversations of, well, first of all, do you find that this is working well? What are some recommendations that you have? And then just putting out some different ideas of different things to consider.
And I wonder about the impact of your work with the teachers, if there's any impact on practice within like administration.
That's a good question. So We had a course in the program that was language history planning and policy, where our teachers were developing language planning and policy proposals. Mm-hmm. And so this is, it's a systems-based approach. So I still believe very strongly in the importance of preparing teachers for the work that's done in the classroom. Mm-hmm. However, I believe that it is equally as important for us to look at the system in which teachers work, mm-hmm. and how English learners, multilingual learners, are tracked through systems, because that will impact the efficacy of different decisions that are made at the classroom level. So our teachers would go through and they would analyze the schools and districts that they were in, and then look at research, and then make a proposal of a way to address an unmet need that was in their school or in their district. And some of them would even go as far as to look at the state and to look at state policies, which also impact what happens at the district and at the school level.
Right.
Then with our grant, through the Saturday seminars and the work with the TSSN, our teachers would be working in communities of practice where they are exploring the different actors in the TSSN. And with each seminar, they would come up with different plans of, so what are plans that we can make to help parents get more involved? What are plans we can make to help the school building, change the school building in some way? Then by the end of the two-year project, these groups would put together a project. So they would identify what's a challenge, what's an opportunity that we see, and what's a way that we can propose something or develop something in our school or our district that's going to engage parents, family, and the community to support English learners and multilingual learners in the schools. And what we found resulted from that is we had a lot of teachers who started sharing their proposals with administrators. We did have one teacher who identified that a bilingual program may serve learners in her school better, and they gave her permission to start that first bilingual program. And she's that teacher in that bilingual classroom. National Public Radio did a story on it. It was just so great to see. Wow. Here's a teacher. She proposed this and she made it happen. Then we get other teachers. They'll look at their group projects. They'll talk with their schools, with their administrators. They'll work on getting different aspects of that put into place. A lot of our content teachers, they started out the program thinking, you know, I still love math, I still have science, I still have ELA, I'm going to just do that. And then they do the program and they say, you know what, I love working with English learners and I'm going to apply for a position to support ELs. And they tell us that they will talk about materials that they put together through the Saturday seminars, through the final group project that they did in our grant. And these are things that not only help them get the job, but then it helps them with initial ideas, because not only do they have the plans that they created, but they've heard all the other plans from other groups that were presented at the same time. So a lot of our teachers find that, first of all, coming up with plans themselves to address the needs that they identify, first of all, it's very empowering. Because as I talk to a lot of teachers there, I often find that there's this sense that I don't have a voice. And our goal is to help them recognize just how important their voice is. So teacher agency is another big thing that I'm just a big proponent of. And with that, it's having a voice and finding how do you express that? How do you put it together in a way that you can communicate it to administration, to other people, so that people can understand what this is, right, and they see the thought that's behind it. And then it makes it easier to put into practice. So there's that. And then when our teachers present and then they see other groups, they'll start to see, okay, there's some overlap, and that helps reinforce a lot of ideas that they have when they see that other groups of teachers are coming to some of the same conclusions, or they're identifying some of the same challenges or seeing some of the same opportunities. But then they also, they find, this is something we didn't think about. And this is something that we can add in. So a lot of the teachers will say, we really stand by what we did, but we would add this little component here. We would add to that.
And again, capitalizing on the assets.
Yes, yes.
Yes, yes. I love it. And I also, as you were talking and talking about actors, I once again noticed your reference to drama.
Well, so it's actually not a reference to drama. So there's this article by Zhao that we've read, which is Actors in Language Planning and Policy.
Okay.
And so in this article, he's actually looking at who are the actors. And so that term comes from this particular reference. Okay. You're not the first person to make that connection where someone said, oh, you know, DJ, this is your this is your interest in drama that's coming in. It just so happens that term actor is used. And so we use that because it's an article that we've used, and then that term actor gets used in some of the other literature. Mm-hmm. And it just, I don't know, we've just kind of stuck with actors, so the seven different actors that are in the TSSM.
Yeah, and every actor plays a role, a certain role.
Yeah, exactly, there's that right. Also, yes.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah, okay. If you were to give some advice, maybe teachers that might be interested in moving a process forward like this, what advice would you give?
So I think the further I've gotten into my career, I think less and less about what are the answers and more about what are the questions.
Hmm.
So I start a lot of projects with what are the questions that we need to answer. So when a school or a university or any group brings me in, that's usually where I start, is what are the questions? So I would suggest that people make a list of questions and not assume that they know all the answers to the questions, but make a list of these questions and then start to ask these questions of your different actors, of different constituents, different people that are part of this system, to get a better sense of how everyone views this. I think that's what we have found the most rewarding from this. So my colleagues, Dr. Soham Mansouri and Shane Kennedy, three of us have been meeting frequently as we go through artifacts that the teachers have created. And we came up with questions. We came up with different activities for them to do. And now we're seeing what exploration of what are the different topics, what are the different themes, what are the different challenges, what are the different opportunities, and then what are some of these suggested solutions that they have, and just how organic that is to come from that. So our next big goal is, after going through and analyzing these artifacts and highlighting, coming up with lists and tagging things, is to write up each of the actors in the TSSM as a chapter and to publish this as a book. So we see this as sort of twofold. So one is there's the curriculum. So having these activities, which asks a number of questions to explore.
Mm-hmm.
And then having what are teachers' voices and what are the results that came from that. And I think part of that that's important is, so we're in St. Louis. St. Louis is its own context our immigration patterns here, our history of foreign-born, our history of multilingual learners and communities is different from so many other parts of the country. And within the area, it changes from school to school and district to district. And then the needs also change from level to level. So when you look at early childhood, elementary, middle school, high school, that changes. So we're looking at how different teachers from these different backgrounds in different schools come up with this. So what our teachers in the St. Louis area have come to as possible solutions may not be the same that you would find in New York. Right. It may not be the same as you would find in the Chicago area or in the Kansas City area or in Texas. So all these different places, you're going to find something that's different. So I think that's so kind of coming back around to your question is, I think what I might say is avoid canned solutions. Because we're looking at systems and how those systems work and how we need to move those systems and identify what is already available that changes. Just for example, we'll be looking through data from teachers, and one group will say that churches are not as active and not as involved, and then another group will say that churches and religious organizations are playing a very important and vital role. So this means that based on perceptions and where people are, that they may find that the role of religious communities,
right,
which are very important in many immigrant and multilingual communities, will play different roles. So identifying that and seeing, is this already viewed as an asset, or is this an asset that maybe we can bring in and help with the system that we're working with.
And I also liked the fact that you included the world, because a lot of times we focus a lot on, you know, connecting with the community, mm-hmm. but we don't go past that. So I like the fact that you include
yes.
that.
Yes, I'd be happy to talk about that. So models that we looked at, it didn't include the world. And honestly, I can't remember where that came from. It probably just came from some of those early conversations. So the activity we do for Seminar 7 with the world is we ask our teachers to come up with a list of four different English learners that they work with and the countries that they're from. So they need four different countries. Mm-hmm. Then we ask them, go online and find news and headlines about these four countries. So then they write down what these different stories are. And then we ask them, so what kind of stories are you finding? So let's take, for instance, we got students from Ukraine. So what stories are our teachers going to find when they go on Twitter, on New York Times, CNN, wherever they go? What headlines are they going to see about Ukraine right now? And we have a discussion of what does this look like, or what does this feel like for our ELs, our multilingual learners, and their families, that these are the stories that are most readily available in our society that is very, you know, everything's at our fingertips on our phone right. to look it up. So then they are asked to keep with those same four countries and now start doing searches to identify stories of positive news and positive stories from these countries. And they do say it takes a little more time, but they're able to find stories. They're able to find these great stories that are about countries from which their ELs and their families come from. And then they come up with a plan for sharing out these stories. So how do we come up with ways to share out positive things about the countries from which our learners come from? Because think about it, with from the United States, do we want to hear negative stories about our country that say negative things about our country, or do we want to hear positive stories about the United States? So we'll look for these positive stories, and those are the positive stories that we want to share. So if we do that, for those of us who are American-born, can we do the same thing for our foreign-born, for our students with our heritage language learners? This really helped change things. And so again, it's activities like this. It's one thing to walk into a group of teachers and just tell them to do this.
Right.
If you tell them to do this, then it's just, they'll tune you out. Well, some will tune you out. Others will be on board. But I will say, working with teachers and having them first come up with who are the learners we're working with. We've got four different countries. They find stories. They have this aha moment. This is what we're finding. And then when they find that they can find great stories about the countries from which their learners are coming from and their heritage, they love this because they are thinking about individual learners that they're working with. They're thinking about their families, and they're aware of challenges. They're aware of things that are going on in the world, but they're finding ways to promote a positive sense of self-worth, which is what all our learners need. All of our learners need to see themselves reflected in the curriculum, reflected in the classroom culture. We get a lot of teachers who will focus on making sure that there are flags that are visible throughout, getting how to say hello, pieces of their language throughout. But then when they start looking at news is a harder one. And yeah, then sharing those,
yeah,
that always becomes a very transformative one. That's a fun module when we do that one.
I bet. And definitely a change in perspective, right?
Yes.
A full complete 180 sometimes. Dr. Kaiser, I think we could probably spend a lot more time talking about this. And I really appreciate you taking the time to have this conversation with me. And I can see how it emanates from you, all of this work, and how it's just how it makes you happy and just keeps you going. It's contagious for sure.
Good. That's the type of thing that I want to be spreading. Yeah. And, seeing our teachers as they go through our program, as they go through our grant, and just seeing how they get excited about things and they spread it to others, mm-hmm, and it spreads to their learners. And that's what we need. It spreads to their families. It spreads to the communities.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And although this is, I know we're going to just share the audio, but it's, seeing you face to face and seeing your enthusiasm is very evident.
Thank you.
I really appreciate you taking the time to talk with me today. And we look forward to welcoming you as our keynote at the 2023 Symposium on Emergent Multilingual Learners in Early Childhood.
Thank you. I look forward to that.
Yeah. Thank you for listening today. If you would like to learn more about the brilliant guest we had on today's episode or any of the resources we discussed, please visit the Mid-State Auburn webpage. This podcast is produced by Mid-State Auburn at OCM BOCES, and our theme music is Catalyst from Purple Planet Music. We hope that you'll tune in next time for more of Our Burning Questions.